Hello, and welcome to today's reading of the New York Times. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll start with a front page article from the Wednesday, April 24th edition, headlined, Witness Recalls Burying Stories to Shield Trump. This front page article by Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protes, and Maggie Haberman. Donald Trump had a dismal day in court on Tuesday as the judge presiding over his criminal trial told a defense lawyer he was losing all credibility, and a key witness pulled back the curtain to expose what prosecutors called a conspiracy to influence the 2016 election. The witness was David Pecker, longtime publisher of the National Enquirer, and he transported jurors back to a crucial 2015 meeting with Mr. Trump and his fixer at Trump Tower in Midtown Manhattan. Prosecutors called it the Trump Tower Conspiracy, arguing that Mr. Pecker, Mr. Trump, and Michael Cohen, then Mr. Trump's personal lawyer and fixer, hatched a plot at the meeting to conceal sex scandals looming over Mr. Trump's campaign. Their effort led to Mr. Pecker's tabloids to buy and bury two damaging stories about Mr. Trump. Mr. Cohen also purchased the silence of a porn star, a deal at the heart of the case against the former president. In gripping testimony on Tuesday, Mr. Pecker took the jurors inside the meeting, recalling how Mr. Cohen and Mr. Trump asked what he and his magazines, fixtures of American supermarket checkout lines, could do to help the campaign. The account bolstered the prosecution's argument that the men were protecting not just Mr. Trump's personal reputation, but his political fortunes. "I would be your eyes and ears," Mr. Pecker recalled telling them, as he explained the tabloid practice of catch and kill, in which an outlet bought the rights to a story, only to never publish it. Mr. Pecker's testimony came after a bruising hearing for Mr. Trump and his legal team, as prosecutors argued that the trial is threatened by Mr. Trump's repeated attacks on witnesses and jurors, mostly launched on social media and his campaign website. They urged the judge, Juan Merchan, to hold Mr. Trump in contempt over what they said were 11 violations of a gag order that bars the former president from attacking witnesses, prosecutors, jurors, and court staff, as well as their relatives. When Mr. Trump's lead lawyer, Todd Blanche, claimed that the former president was trying to comply with the order, Justice Merchan signaled that he found that preposterous, replying with words that no lawyer wants to hear, "You're losing all credibility with the court." The case against Mr. Trump, the first American president to face a criminal trial, centers on Mr. Cohen's $130,000 hush money payment to the porn star Stormy Daniels. Prosecutors say he paid Ms. Daniels at Mr. Trump's direction during a 2016 campaign to keep her quiet about a sexual tryst she said she had with Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump's lawyer, in his opening statements, denied that his client had slept with Ms. Daniels, echoing what Mr. Trump has consistently said. Mr. Trump, who faces up to 4 years behind bars if convicted, is charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records for the way he accounted for the $130,000 repayment to Mr. Cohen. Each count reflects a different false check, ledger, and invoice that, according to prosecutors, Mr. Trump used to disguise the reimbursement's true purpose. Mr. Trump, once again the presumptive Republican nominee, faces three other criminal cases in three cities on charges that he plotted to overturn his 2020 election loss and mishandled classified records once he was no longer president. But with those cases delayed, the Manhattan case may be the only one to make it to trial before Election Day. The Manhattan case, in just its sixth day, has become a media and political spectacle as Mr. Trump's campaign-style attacks on Mr. Cohen and the jury test the limits of the legal system and the judge's patience. At the gag order hearing, held with the jury out of the courtroom, demonstrated a jarring reality for Mr. Trump as he seeks to reclaim the White House while under indictment. His political reflexes and the norm-busting ethos that has defined the Trump era often clash with the letter of the law. Witnesses in the case rightly fear being subjected to the former president's vitriol, a prosecutor, Christopher Conroy, told the judge. He rattled off statements that Manhattan prosecutors believe crossed the line, including calling Mr. Cohen and Ms. Daniels sleazebags and reposting an attack on the jury pool. That happened the night before a juror who had already been seated asked to be excused. What happened here was exactly what this order was meant to prevent, and the defendant doesn't care, Mr. Conroy said. Also from today's front page, in a front page article by J. Edward Moreno, FTC bans non-compete clauses, freeing workers to join rivals. The Federal Trade Commission on Tuesday said employers could no longer, in most cases, stop their employees from going to work for rival companies. The sweeping action could help create jobs, raise wages, and increase competition among businesses, the agency said. But the action is all but certain to be challenged in court by businesses that say they need to protect trade secrets and confidential information. The move bars contracts known as non-competes, which prevents workers from leaving for a competitor for a certain amount of time in most circumstances. Non-competes cover about 30 million U.S. workers, the Trade Commission said, in a variety of jobs that include TV news producers, hairdressers, corporate executives, and computer engineers. The commission has said the proposal could raise wages by forcing companies to compete harder for talent. It was approved in a 3-2 vote. Commissioners Melissa Holyoke and Andrew Ferguson, both Republicans, voted against the measure. The FTC's final rule to ban non-competes will ensure Americans have the freedom to pursue a new job, start a new business, or bring a new idea to market, the commission's chair, Lena Khan, said in a statement. She estimated the decision would lead to the creation of 8,500 startups in a year and up to $488 billion in increased wages for workers over the next decade. President Biden celebrated the FTC's vote in a social media post. "Workers ought to have the right to choose who they want to work for," he wrote on X. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce vowed to sue the FTC to block the proposal, calling it an unlawful power grab in a statement shortly after the vote. The chamber, as well as the two dissenting commissioners, has argued that the FTC doesn't have the authority to address this issue and that it should be left to the states. Non-compete contracts affecting senior executives can remain in effect, the commission said, but employers are barred from trying to impose new non-competes on any employee, including executives. The new rule defines executives as employees in policymaking positions who make at least $151,164 annually. It orders employers to notify non-executive employees bound by an existing non-compete that it will no longer be enforceable. Inside a decision at Columbia that escalated campus unrest. This front page article by Nicholas Fandos and Sharon Otterman. Just after 2 p.m. last Wednesday, Namat Shafik, the president of Columbia University, stepped out of an office building on Capitol Hill and into an idling black SUV. She had just endured an intense grilling by a congressional committee investigating anti-Semitism on elite college campuses. Now, a fresh challenge was rapidly building back at her own turf, where pro-Palestinian student demonstrators had staked out an encampment dominating Columbia's lawn. For a university trying to reassure Congress that it was getting its campus under control, the timing could scarcely have been worse. With a narrow window to act, Dr. Shafik directed her car to a law firm near the White House, where she set up a makeshift command center. The secretive deliberations that followed over 24 frantic hours have sent Columbia into a crisis over free speech and safety, unlike any the campus has seen since 1968. The events also set off a chain reaction, rattling campuses across the country, just as one of the most trying academic years in memory neared its end. In theory, Dr. Shafik had a range of options to deal with the protests and protect Jewish students. In the moment, though, she saw little choice, according to three people who described the private discussions. Her testimony had pointed toward coming down hard on the protesters. Despite brief attempts to negotiate with them and objections from leaders on campus, Dr. Shafik ordered that what she later conceded was an extraordinary step. She suspended the students and ordered New York City police in riot gear to arrest more than 100 activists who refused to leave on Thursday afternoon. But instead of quelling the protests, Dr. Shafik's decision appeared to backfire. By this week, she was besieged on all sides. Student protesters were unbowed, and soon the encampment had regrown to be even larger than before. Dr. Shafik's own faculty threatened to revolt over an unprecedented assault on student rights. At least one major Jewish donor cut off support. And while the White House voiced deep concern, the very Republican lawmakers she had set out to appeal to called for her resignation. It's the most significant test Columbia has confronted since its recovery from 68, said Robert McCaughey, a longtime university professor who has written a history of Columbia, suggesting that there were real questions whether Dr. Shafik, an Egyptian-born economist, could outlast it. Student demonstrations for the Palestinian cause have become a constant feature of select college campuses since the Israel-Hamas war broke out. Many activists, including some Jewish students who support the movement, say they are fighting to preserve human life in Gaza, where local health officials say more than 30,000 people have died, and to end Israel's oppression of Palestinians. But demonstrations from the left have also included, at times, anti-Semitic hate speech, threats and outright support for Hamas. In recent days, non-student protesters gathered outside Columbia's gates have used especially vitriolic rhetoric that has left some Jewish students feeling unsafe. Now, with only days of classes left in the spring semester, neither side appears to have a clear endgame. University leaders are counting the days until summer, hoping to protect May's commencement ceremonies from disruption. Columbia faces one of the most complex balancing acts between protecting students on campus and respecting its deeply cherished commitment to academic freedom. The university is home to large Jewish and Arab student populations and boasts a leading Middle Eastern Studies department, a dual degree program with Tel Aviv University, and a rich history of student activism dating back to the 1960s. In other national news, court system will publish transcripts from the trial. Matthew Hagg and Ellen Feuer wrote this article. If you want to follow Donald Trump's criminal trial in detail, but can't make it to the lower Manhattan courthouse in person, you can still read every word of the proceedings. The New York State court system will publish a transcript of each day's court action by the end of the following day on its website. The transcripts can be found at nycourts.gov under People v. Donald J. Trump. The trial is not televised, nor is there live audio, so the transcripts provide the only way to read what is said in the courtroom, word for word. The court system does not normally release daily transcripts for public consumption, and in most cases, seeing transcripts for a court proceeding can be costly. But the court system's chief administrative judge, Joseph Zayas, believed it was the right thing to do. This measure is in the interest of the public good and aligns with the court system's commitment to judicial transparency and its ongoing efforts to enhance public access to and understanding of the courts and justice system, said the judge who made the decision to publish the transcripts. In addition to the transcripts, the court website also includes various documents from the hush money trial, including the 42 questions asked of prospective jurors during jury selection. The site also includes some documents from Mr. Trump's civil fraud case, as well as the previous criminal fraud case against Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. And in a related story, this one by William Rashbaum, considering the logistics of jailing an ex-president. The U.S. Secret Service is in the business of protecting the president, whether he's inside the Oval Office or visiting a foreign war zone. But protecting a former president in prison? The prospect is unprecedented. That would be the challenge if Donald Trump, whom the agency is required by law to protect around the clock, is convicted at his criminal trial in Manhattan and sentenced to serve time. Even before the trial's opening statement, the Secret Service was in some measure planning for the extraordinary possibility of a former president behind bars. Prosecutors had asked the judge in the case to remind Mr. Trump that attacks on witnesses and jurors could land him in jail, even before a verdict is rendered. Last week, as a result of the prosecution's request, officials with federal, state, and city agencies had an impromptu meeting about how to handle the situation, according to two people with knowledge of the matter. That behind-the-scenes conversation, involving officials from the Secret Service and other relevant law enforcement agencies, focused only on how to move and protect Mr. Trump if the judge were to order him briefly jailed for contempt in a courthouse holding cell, people said. A far more substantial challenge, how to safely incarcerate a former president if the jury convicts him, and the judge sentences him to prison rather than home confinement or probation. That has yet to be addressed directly, according to some of a dozen current and former city, state, and federal officials interviewed for this article. But the daunting challenge remains, and not just for Secret Service and prison officials, who would face the logistical nightmare of safely incarcerating Mr. Trump, who is also the presumptive Republican nominee for president. Obviously, it's uncharted territory, said Martin Horn, who has worked at the highest levels of New York's and Pennsylvania's state prison agencies and served as commissioner of New York City's correction and probation departments. Certainly, no state prison system has had to deal with this before, and no federal prison has to either. Turning now to international news, in a front-page article by David Sanger, modern warfare gets mired in Ukraine trenches. The idea triggered a full-scale revolt on the Google campus. 6 years ago, the Silicon Valley giant signed a small $9 million contract to put the skills of a few of its most innovative developers to the task of building an artificial intelligence tool that would help the military detect potential targets on the battlefield using drone footage. Engineers and other Google employees argued that the company should have nothing to do with Project Maven, even if it was designed to help the military discern between civilians and militants. The uproar forced the company to back out, but Project Maven didn't die. It just moved to other contractors. Now it has grown into an ambitious experiment being tested on the front lines in Ukraine, forming a key component of the U.S. military's effort to funnel timely information to the soldiers fighting Russian invaders. So far, the results are mixed. Generals and commanders have a new way to put a full picture of Russia's movements and communications into one big user-friendly picture, employing algorithms to predict where troops are moving and where attacks might have happened. But the American experience in Ukraine has underscored how difficult it is to get 21st century data into 19th century trenches. Even with Congress on the brink of providing tens of billions of dollars in aid to Kyiv, mostly in the form of ammunition and long-range artillery, the question remains whether the new technology will be enough to help turn the tide of the war at a moment when the Russians appear to have regained momentum. The war in Ukraine has, in the minds of many American officials, been a bonanza for the U.S. military, a testing ground for Project Maven and other rapidly evolving technologies. The American-made drones that were shipped into Ukraine last year were blown out of the sky with ease. And if Pentagon officials now understand, in a way that they never did before, that America's system of military satellites has to be built and set up entirely differently, with configurations that look more like Elon Musk's Starlink constellations of small satellites. Meanwhile, American, British, and Ukrainian officers, along with some of Silicon Valley's top military contractors, are exploring new ways of finding and exploiting Russian vulnerabilities, even while U.S. officials try to navigate legal restraints about how deeply they can become involved in targeting and killing Russian troops. But if Russia's brutal assault on Ukraine has been a testing ground for the Pentagon's drive to embrace advanced technology, it has also been a bracing reminder of the limits of technology to turn the war. Ukraine's ability to repel the invasion arguably hinges on more renewed deliveries of basic weapons and ammunition, especially artillery shells. The first 2 years of the conflict have also shown that Russia is adapting much more quickly than anticipated to the technology that gave Ukraine an initial edge. For a while, we thought this would be a cyber war, General Mark Milley, who retired last year as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said last summer. Then we thought it was looking like an old-fashioned World War II tank war. Then he said, there were days when it seemed like as though they were fighting World War I. And in a front-page article by Vivian Yi and Bilal Shabir, trapped and starving, two families try to keep their children alive. Born in wartime, the baby had not eaten in more than a day, his father said. No formula, no nothing. His parents had already spent the last of their money on food, sold his mother's gold jewelry to buy milk, and begged water from other evacuees to mix with the powdered formula. Now, even that was gone. The baby, Jihad, and his parents, Nur Barda and Hiba al-Arkan, were trapped in a storage closet with five other people at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza last month as Israeli troops attacked. They had some Palestinian thyme and foraged wild greens, but only that, and just enough water to moisten their mouths once in a while, Mr. Barda told a Times reporter. Gunfire jackhammered outside. The Israeli military had surrounded the building and told anyone sheltering inside to stay put. Al-Shifa was the same hospital where Jihad had been born 5 months earlier, 5 months of searching all day for a little food, of nearly getting knifed over a little flour. All of his parents could do now was sit and watch their son go hungry. Hungry herself, Ms. Al-Arkan had no breast milk to give. After 2 days, they had had enough. Jihad had not eaten in 28 hours. Holding one of Jihad's dirty white T-shirts up on a broomstick, holding the baby close, they made their way toward the Israeli soldiers. They left for southern Gaza that same day, they said, alongside other civilians fleeing the hospital. Israel's invasion of the northern part of the territory, where the family lived before the war and had been sheltering ever since, meant that there was nothing left for them there but starvation. In Gaza, where Israel has cut off most of the territory's pre-war water and food supplies, and war has made farming nearly impossible, the United Nations says famine is likely to set in by the end of May. Aid groups and many governments blame heavy-handed Israeli restrictions on aid to Gaza. Israel, which had previously charged the United Nations with failing to distribute aid adequately, promised recently to ramp up deliveries after facing enormous outside pressure. Oxfam, an aid group, has calculated that hundreds of thousands of people in northern Gaza, which has been closed for months to all but a small dribble of aid, are trying to survive on an average of 245 calories a day. When people in Gaza begin starving to death on a large scale, experts say, it will happen first to the north, and the first to the most vulnerable, children with pre-existing medical conditions, older adults, and the infants born under siege who have never known a full meal. What forced me to put up my hands and go down to the soldiers in the hospital was that there was a risk my little baby was going to starve, said Mr. Barda. Children in Gaza are already dying for lack of food. At least 28 children younger than 12 had died of malnutrition in hospitals as of April 17th, according to local health officials, including 12 less than a month old. Dozens more, those officials say, have most likely died outside of medical centers. Elsewhere internationally, vilification of Muslims is a brazen display of Modi's power. This article by Mujib Mashal. Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, his power at home secured and his Hindu-first vision deeply entrenched, has set his sights in recent years on a role as a global statesman, riding India's economic and diplomatic rise. In doing so, he's distanced himself from his party's staple work of polarizing India's diverse population along religious lines for its own electoral gain. His silence has provided tacit backing as vigilante groups continue to target non-Hindu minority groups, and as members of his party routinely used hateful and racist language, even in parliament, against the largest of those groups, India's 200 million Muslims. With the pot kept boiling, Mr. Modi's subtle dog whistles, with references to Muslim dress or burial places, could go a long way domestically, while providing enough deniability to ensure that red carpets remained rolled out abroad for the man leading the world's largest democracy. And amid outcry, Russia orders a U.S. reporter to stay in jail. This article by Ivan Necheparenko. A court in Moscow rejected an appeal on Tuesday by the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich against his detention, more than a year after he became the first American journalist arrested on spying charges in Russia since the Cold War. The court ruled that Mr. Gershkovich must stay in a high-security prison in Moscow at least until the end of June, the journal and news agencies reported. With no trial date yet set, Mr. Gershkovich's detention is likely to be extended further. Mr. Gershkovich, his employer, and U.S. government have vehemently rejected the espionage charges against him. The White House has designated Mr. Gershkovich as wrongfully detained, a status tantamount to being a political prisoner. In its statement on Tuesday, the journal said that it continues to be outraged that Evan has been wrongfully detained by the Russian government for more than a year. Evan's freedom is long overdue, and we urge the administration to do everything in their power to secure his release, the statement said. Turning now to metro area news, Adams defends his expected pick for a top lawyer despite the council's opposition. This article by Emma Fitzsimmons and Jeffrey Mays. Mayor Eric Adams on Tuesday said he intended to press forward with his expected nomination of Randy Mastro as New York City's top lawyer, despite mounting opposition from the city council. Mr. Adams and his top aides defended Mr. Mastro, a former aide to Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who is known for his aggressive tactics representing numerous big-name interests and clients, arguing that he had been called the conscience of the Giuliani administration. The mayor said it was unfair to attack Mr. Mastro for his clients, which include the former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, in the investigation of the George Washington Bridge lane closings, the state of New Jersey in an ongoing lawsuit against the federal government over congestion pricing, and the energy company Chevron over pollution in the Ecuadorian rainforest. The expected nomination of Mr. Mastro as New York's Corporation Counsel, the lawyer who represents the city, its agencies, and the mayor in civil litigation, comes at a time when the mayor and his top aides are facing a tangle of investigations and lawsuits ahead of his re-election campaign next year. But Mr. Mastro, a former federal prosecutor, must be confirmed by a majority of the 51-member city council. And earlier in the day, 34 members of the council's Black, Latino, and Asian caucus released a statement noting their opposition to his appointment. "We deserve better than someone who has fought for the interests of top earners, abusive corporations, and vindictive politicians," the group said in a statement, adding that the caucus was firm in its opposition and urging the Adams administration to reconsider. Finally today, some facts of interest from today's paper. Recent polls show that a significant majority of Americans now agree that climate change is real, and a smaller majority agree that it is human-caused and harmful. And the cartoonist Chick Young, who created the comic strip Blondie in 1930, briefly wrote out the main character of Dagwood Bumstead. But readers wanted him back. Dagwood returned and married Blondie in 1933. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, April 24th edition of the New York Times. Today's Norwalk Hour is coming up next.